time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at wjcu.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at outspokencyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 17th, 2021. First, I need to begin with a correction. Last week, I mistakenly said that the USA Cycling and UCI Cross Worlds are scheduled to be held in Fayetteville, Arkansas this year. They are actually scheduled for the fall of 2022. There's also no further information about changing the venue at this time. Okay, that's fixed, and I do apologize for any misunderstanding. So this week, the show's about climate and carbon pricing first. There is, of course, a sea change of thought and action in Washington about climate and the need for action. And the bicycle industry has a place in that conversation. To discuss a broad and deep effort from business leaders across the country, including the bicycle industry and its participation, are Randy Salem and Rich Fine from the Business Climate Leaders Organization. The goal? To have the energy, innovation, and carbon dividend passed into law now. Then after our break, it's out to the West Coast to chat with Kendall Young from SpinCycle LLC. Working behind the scenes as the guy behind the guy behind the guy, as he puts it, Kendall matches his clients with product managers to spec bicycles. And after over 30 years in the business, he has some deep insight as well as sage advice as we face months-long waits for parts and accessories. So there's been a lot of talk about carbon pricing, and frankly, I didn't really understand it. I know it's not a new idea, and in fact, what we're going to discuss with Randy Salem and Rich Fine is an effort to finally get the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Bill passed into law. It's been introduced to Congress twice before, but this year, Fred Deutsch from Florida introduced it for a third time. And this time might be different, as momentum builds for a new infrastructure bill that includes climate initiatives to help stem the rise of greenhouse gases. To that end, more than 200,000 people from over 1,000 companies are actively involved in the Business Climate Leaders Organization. Each business sector, including the bicycle industry, has signed an industry declaration laying out the whys and wherefores for immediate action. Hello, Randy and Rich. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guests this week. How are you both?
Fantastic. Good to be here, Diane.
Pleasure here as well, Diane. Thank you for inviting us.
Rich, you are in Portland. Randy, where are you?
Bay Area, Los Altos, California.
Nice, nice. So we're going to talk about a really important topic, and that is climate change, which, you know, we know that the bicycle industry looks at climate change as something where we can affect change ourselves. This gentleman, Tim Kelly, who listens to the show, sent me this wonderful email talking to me about what you are doing. And I think it's important, and I think my listeners will enjoy it. So Business Climate Leaders, and I want to know how the bicycle industry is involved. But first, Randy, tell us who you are and about the organization.
You got it. So Tim is a volunteer with us, one of 200,000 volunteers. He happens to be in Pittsburgh. And as you mentioned, Rich and I are on the West Coast, so we're across all around the country. Part of it, the parent organization, which is Citizens Climate Lobby, a group of passionate individuals trying to come up with solutions that match the scale of the issue in dealing with climate. And Business Climate Leaders is an action team. We are part of Citizen Climate Lobby, specifically working on engaging businesses, because our view is that we need to get everybody on board, from individuals to faith leaders to environmental organizations and also businesses, all working toward leveraging, moving our elected leaders, our members in Congress, towards solutions.
Excellent. So, Rich, give us a little bit of your background and how you are involved. And my guess is you are one of the people, like Tim Kelly is in Pittsburgh, but you're in Portland.
So I've been a climate activist since the early 2000s. And in fact, I started an e-bike specialty shop in Portland specifically to promote bicycling as alternative transportation. To me, this is it's probably the biggest existential threat that we've ever encountered, that I'm aware of, want to protect future generations. I recently sold the shop and was looking for some volunteer work to do. And I came across NPCL and felt what a great way they're putting together this bicycle climate declaration, and what a great way to participate in terms of leveraging my knowledge of the industry and my contacts to help them get more businesses involved.
Perfect. What is the ultimate goal of the Business Climate Leaders Group, and then as it relates to the lobbying organization? I assume that's what it is, a lobbying group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so ultimate objective, create a livable, sustainable world that we can enjoy the incredible beauty that we have, that we've been gifted to be able to bike, surf, have clean air, and have a vibrant economy for all of us to work and take care of our families and our lives. So that's the ultimate thing. That's why we're here and engaged. And as Rich said, climate is the issue that we see as, above all others. And our view and our kind of laser point at how we engage it with the issue is around carbon pricing, is around coming around supporting a solution that is up to the scale of the problem. And from our view, carbon pricing is not the only. We need lots and lots of different policies and lots of different action, but we see carbon pricing as fundamental as a way to deal with the issue of fossil fuel pollution across all industries and all uses as the starting point, as a fundamental place to begin. And we do work on that through meeting with each office of members of Congress 3 to 4 times a year, both in D.C. when we're able to do that, as well as in district. So we are that very persistent and kind and respectful voice that's been there for the last dozen years, keep saying, hey, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. We appreciate the work that you do and the public service that you provide, and we want you and need you to act and put your support behind climate legislation.
My guess is that this new administration is a breath of fresh air relative to the previous 4 years. Is that
true? That could be one of the greatest understatements ever.
Yeah. Quite a relief.
I could not resist it. I could not resist it. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Randy Salem and Rich Fine. They are part of the Business Climate Leaders Group out of, where is it headquartered? I didn't even ask that.
We are virtual before
okay,
COVID.
Where did it used to
be? So Citizen Climate Lobby actually started in Coronado outside of San Diego. So we have a small office there of 25 or 30 people. We have a small office of 5 or 6 people in D.C. But of these 200,000 people that are part of the overall organization, we are everywhere around the country and operating virtually.
Awesome.
Locally, virtually.
So one of the things that I don't quite understand, and if I don't understand it, I'm assuming a percentage of my listeners, if not many of them, do not understand. Explain carbon pricing. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, very simply, it's putting a price that it actually costs you to pollute. So fossil fuels have been fantastic in so many ways to create the world, the life, from our phones to our houses to transport and all the wonderful things that the power through fossil fuels has created. But it's also created a lot of problems, from just pollution, just in our lungs, and asthma and issues that creates, to oil spills and digging and mining, all that. But also, as we know now, it's caused global warming and from the greenhouse gases that it creates, be it from methane or be it from burning and creating CO2. So carbon pricing is simply making that you actually pay for that, the negative parts. Economists call it the externality of smoking. And just like we have done with cigarette smoking, that there's issues with cigarette smoking that we individuals, we can choose to smoke that because it's our body, but it also creates secondhand smoke, which has other impacts in terms of other people around us, which impact the healthcare system, et cetera, et cetera. So we tax cigarettes quite heavily, and we haven't done that. You basically are able to burn fossil fuel, coal, or gas or oil freely. Obviously, you pay for the price of that, but you don't pay for the cost of the society of that.
So even if we put a tax, if we price carbon, so somebody is a polluter and allows this carbon to escape from his or her organization, work, industry, whatever, what is the deterrent? I mean, some people will say, I don't care, I'll just pay the tax. It doesn't matter to me. How is that going to help curb carbon emissions?
First of all, there's some straightforward economics that are going to address part of this. And that's especially the case in the electrical power sector, where this is a cost of fuel. The power companies are going to look for the lowest cost of fuel wherever they can find it. So they're going to start changing fuel sources. And that, in fact, is where the largest impact, especially in the short term, is going to be. So the power companies are going to make their decision, not even a consumer decision at that point. It's a pure economic business decision.
Well, but that brings up something that may or may not come down to the consumer level, at least for me. When gas was $4 a gallon, people still drove their cars. Now, hearing GM say everything's going to be electric in 14 years, that's a change. And so I'm wondering, how quickly will the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, if it is enacted, will actually make a difference? Will this happen like fast enough?
Yeah, so the economics, the research shows that, you know, if you implement the Energy Innovation Act, which we can talk about a little more specifically, but what that is it starts at a $15, relatively low, $15 per metric ton of emissions. What that means is about a 10 to 15 cent increase in a gallon of gas. But going up every year, that price would increase by $10. And as long as you're meeting the expected emissions reductions, then that will continue to go up at that rate. And if you don't meet the necessary reductions in emissions, then the price goes up higher. But the research shows that at that level of pricing, you'd have a 30% decrease in overall U.S. emissions within 5 years. And you would be on pace to get to that zero emissions, so near zero carbon emissions by 2050. So it works actually pretty quickly, because companies, as Rich was talking, in the power sector, they're not only just looking at, you know, what the price is today, they're projecting out 20 and 50 years, because they're making investments based upon, you know, what they're expecting their material, raw material cost to be. So it can have dramatic increases very quickly. And it also will start spurring a lot of innovation, people looking at alternatives. And to your point earlier that when gas is $4 a gallon, you didn't switch, but maybe now you would, because there are a lot more alternatives. Back long ago, you didn't have the different EV options on automobiles. You didn't have the electric bike options. You didn't have a lot of other options which is going to continue to increase those options from solar to other fuels, et cetera.
We're going to take a short break. This is a really interesting conversation. I want to bring it back to how the bicycle industry and specifically people who ride bicycles can influence this. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have BikeLaw as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to BikeLaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Randy Salem and Rich Fine. We're talking about the business climate leaders, and there are many, many, many of them around the country. And we're trying to get an Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act passed in Congress. So I wanted to ask Rich about the bicycle industry's involvement. There's a declaration that we're being asked to sign. So tell us a little bit about that declaration and why somebody like me or my listeners would want to sign on to it.
Well, the declaration is primarily targeted for businesses in the bike industry. Individuals can sign it too, but it is a statement of support for carbon pricing and acknowledge the impact that carbon pollution is having on our climate. I will say that probably the best impact that consumers can have, along with signing it or acknowledging this themselves, would be to go to their bike shop, to go to the bike manufacturers and ask them to agree to the declaration. Not only the declaration, which acknowledges these problems and acknowledges the need for carbon pricing, but also to support the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act to do both.
What about going to legislators? I mean, I know that's what the base organization is doing, is sort of lobbying Congress about this act, but if I were to contact Sherrod Brown or any of my other representatives here in Ohio and say, look at this, of course, many of them have already maybe signed on to it. Is that something that you would recommend people can do or might want to do?
Yeah, I'll jump in here if I may, Rich. Absolutely is the answer. That is the heart of democracy, which is individuals speaking up. So, yes, absolutely. It's wonderful to have you and all of us in our districts talking to our members of Congress. But then the next level of that is getting other influencers, right, be that your local church, be that your local Kiwanis Club, Elks Club, you know, Rotary, different organizations that you're involved in. And particularly when it comes to economic issues, as this is becoming, getting businesses involved, and particularly with conservative members of Congress, they need to hear from businesses. And I think that's been an issue in the past in terms of getting climate legislation passed, is there's been, you know, a lot of naysayers, and that has come from people like the organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other, you know, the oil companies, other leading kind of businesses saying, yes, it's going to cost jobs, it's going to be bad for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But we know that is not true. It's a real false narrative. We've seen in California, where we've had a carbon price in place for over decades, the economy's done well. There's been tons of innovation, and we've lowered our emissions. It's happened in other countries, but we need people and we need businesses to speak up. And this is our way to get the bike industry engaged and have their voice heard with members of Congress.
Carbon pricing is not new. It's been implemented in California. It's been implemented in British Columbia. A Canadian friend of mine said the Supreme Court has just approved it to be implemented nationwide. It's being implemented in several European countries and is scheduled to be implemented across the entire EU in 2023.
I guess the question is, given the way Congress has or has not been able to work lately, I know the new administration is doing a lot of workarounds, but what are the odds, if you want to call it that, that this will actually go somewhere? We do have a new Secretary of Transportation. We have an enormous infrastructure bill on the table right now. And I know this has to be part of that because that is what they're talking about, climate. So is there a good chance that this will pass? It's already been introduced into Congress as a bill. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it's been in the last two Congresses, and it was just reintroduced by Representative Deutsch of Florida last Thursday. So there's the $1 trillion question, right? There is going to be, I certainly hope, an infrastructure bill put through, and there is going to be, and there's already, as you mentioned, a lot of different climate initiatives that have been put as part of that. They were put as part of the stimulus package earlier. So there's definitely a lot of movement in positive direction for climate. And you have individuals from John Kerry to Janet Yellen, very senior people within the Biden administration,
right,
who are very favorable to believe that putting a price on pollution is essential as part of an overall package. Senator Coons from Delaware, who's a good friend and advisor to the president, had a bill in the Senate last Congress on carbon pricing. So there's a lot of activity in this area. Whether something will get in or not, you know, wow, it's anybody's guess. But the only way it's going to get in if more and more people, more and more businesses, more and more organizations say that this is something that we need to have. And the reality is that the majority of even Republicans believe that climate is important to deal with, that we need to have climate legislation, and having fossil fuel companies burden the cost of that is a good way to go forward.
The one aspect of this is that it's fiscally neutral.
I think what Rich is saying is important is that it's neutral in the sense that the money comes in, it's paid for by the fossil fuel companies upon extracting the fossil fuel. All that money, which will end up being a trillion dollars over time, all that money is given back to individuals, U.S. citizens, that they can then deal with the increased fossil fuel costs in terms of gasoline they're producing, in terms of their home heating. But then they can also make choices to buy bikes with that money, to do things that will lower their carbon footprint. And on the whole, the majority of Americans would be better off in the end.
Yes, I get it. It also changes behavior, which is what we're really trying to do, is change behavior. And riding a bicycle is changing behavior from getting in your car to go 1 mile to the post office, or, you know, a half a mile to the grocery store. So, yes. Well, the last thing I'd like to ask is how listeners can find out more and maybe have a conversation with their representatives and with their bike shops. I like that idea, although bike shops have a whole bunch of other issues right now, but that would be good.
Well, you can find us at businessclimateleaders.org. And if you go under the top right, you'll see Take Action. And if you go down there, there's a number of different initiatives that we have in various industries, from the wine industry to the brewery industry to solar, and including you'll find the bike industry initiative. And you can share that with your local bike shops. You can share that with associations that you're involved in around biking. You can share that with manufacturers. We're trying to get everybody to the table. And then as we get more and more individual shops and manufacturers, we're working with the associations like the National Bike Dealers Association and People for Bikes, and trying to kind of work our way up to larger organizations to all engage. And you can also, as individuals, join Citizens Climate Lobby. Go to citizensclimatelobby.org, and you can join our teams that engage with your legislators, to write letters to your legislators, to get involved in everything from environmental justice to engaging companies, et cetera. So there's a place for everybody to get involved.
Well, Randy Salem and Rich Fine, business climate leaders, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's a fascinating conversation. It dovetails right in with everything else that we do here on the show, from urban planning and advocacy to getting everybody on a bike. Thank you for talking with me. Good luck. I hope the initiative gets through Congress this term.
So do we. Same here. We appreciate it.
Same here.
All right.
Thanks
you guys,
very much, Diane.
Yeah. Have a great day. My thanks to Randy and Rich. If you're interested in learning more about the Business Climate Leaders, you can log on to businessclimateleaders.org. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with Kendall Young from Spin Cycle LLC. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. My next guest offers a down-to-earth explanation of what has happened in the bike industry. Reasons you can't get tires or tubes or whatever else your bike shop and even online sellers can't offer you at this time. Kendall Young works with high-end European brands and talks to all the U.S. product managers to spec products that we all want to buy, or are at least trying to buy. In an editorial for Bicycle Retailer and Industry News titled "The Value of Diversifying the Supply Chain," Kendall stresses a need to move from single-source suppliers to multi-source options, and as our conversation unfolds, he also explains the reality of the shortages and what we can expect and when. Hello, Kendall. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. And I'm really excited to be able to talk with you. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks so much. And it's a pleasure to speak with you and with anybody else listening. It's a great opportunity. So thank you for that.
And it is my pleasure. So before we actually began this conversation for real, you were saying some interesting things about the bicycle industry, and we'll get to the reason you and I are speaking to begin with, which is based off of an editorial you wrote a couple weeks ago. But talk to me about this idea of the bicycle business being like a pizza.
Right. Well, sure. So from my perspective, before we dive into the minutiae of our conversation today, meta system, I would say the bike industry is like a pizza because all of us, whether you're at the retail side, at the advocacy side, whether you're making bicycles, et cetera, it's whatever part of the cycling industry you touch, whether it's media or hard goods product, et cetera, it's like a pizza in that all of that feeds towards the center. You might have a perspective on the bike industry or your participation in it, but the bottom line is we all love bicycles, and that all leads towards the center, whether you do OEM, which is first cost business, which I do, or whether you do advocacy or media, or you come from the retail side. I think we all appreciate the value of the bicycle, and we may have different contributions to that community, but it all feeds towards the main, is I guess my point.
And that's an interesting way of putting it. I've always looked at all of the factions, and I hate to use that word, but I feel that way sometimes, of the bicycle industry. You have track, and you have road, and you have commuting, and you have recreation, and you have transportation, you have all this. And somehow the industry has never been cohesive enough to market just the idea of cycling. It has to be a certain kind of cycling. And so that's always annoyed me, but that's another story, I guess.
Yeah, no, I just want to comment. I do understand what you mean by that. So I've been in the bike industry for about 30 years, which is amazing, but you wouldn't know me from Adam had you not seen, you know, what I had written for Brain, but I'm definitely an old guy in the bike business. One thing that I have noticed in doing business in the EU and the United States, to amplify your point, is that here, I think we're much more siloed, I would say. You know, there's road cyclists, there's cyclocross, there's, you know, mountain bikes, et cetera. In Europe, I see a lot of bicycles used in a much broader sense, particularly Germany, a lot of the EU, to be clearer. E-bikes have been around, and city bikes and bike shares have been around for, you know, 20 years. And here we're just starting to get, you know, I live in Oakland, California. We're just starting to get decent infrastructure around bicycle lanes just in Oakland and San Francisco, which is a major metro city for the United States. So it's just a different approach, the EU versus the United States. But we're getting there. We're heading in the right direction. It's not there yet.
I certainly hope so.
Yes, I do too.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Kendall Young. So his company is called Spin Cycle. It is an LLC corporation in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's OEM, meaning Original Equipment Manufacturer Brand Management Company. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about what you do is it's not like you represent any of the big brands like Shimano. Correct. Or Campagnolo or mm-hmm. SRAM. That is not what you do. So you mm-hmm. do have a perspective that I think is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. The editorial said you were the guy behind the guy behind the guy, which I thought was so interesting. I mean, I caught it right away. But explain sure. what you mean by that and exactly what it is you do.
Sure. Let me first explain what I do and why I explain myself that way. So my company is Spin Cycle LLC. It's an OEM brand management firm. And what I do is I work with the product managers. I call on virtually every brand in the United States, small, medium, and large. And I talk to the product managers, and I represent a handful of European highline cycling goods. And what product managers do, you know, by the time a bicycle reaches a retailer, you just look at it and you understand the specifications on it and you sell it based on those specifications. And hopefully that product manager for Jamus, GT, Haro, Mazzi, whatever brand you happen to have on the floor, has done their job in a way that allows that brand to differentiate in the marketplace. Think of it this way. A product manager is the chef and a couple of guys like me are behind them. We're just running to the freezer to get the dough. That's it. So when I say I'm the guy behind the guy behind the guy, most of your listeners today, I would say, probably have some form of outward-facing job. You know, your school teacher, an attorney, a food service worker, et cetera. All of those are outward-facing where you're meeting the public. You could be in the bike industry your entire 50-year career and never meet somebody like me because there wouldn't be any cause for you to do so. An example of how a product manager works. Like when you go to buy a car, for instance, you see that big list that's in the window, right? It lists all the things. So for every consumer good that we have, even the laptop you're on right now, Diana, there was one day when a whole bunch of button guys showed up to that laptop company and they listened to 5 presentations. And at the end of the day, they said, we'll take that button guy. And then door closes. And the next day, a screen guy shows up and, you know, 5 screen guys show up and they listen to the presentations and pick a screen guy. So anyway, my point is that that's how bicycles are built. And it looks haphazard by the time a bicycle ends up on the shop floor, but it's not haphazard at all because there are product managers that are sort of chefs that are, you know, mixing up different combination of parts. And here's the main point. The bottom line is at the end of the day, when their job is done, they're hoping that their mix of parts is just a little different and a little better. And helps differentiate their brand in the market compared to the next guy and the next brand doing exactly the same thing.
What a great explanation.
I hope that was useful and not
It's very useful, and I think it makes a lot of sense. So since you wrote your editorial, which was just fascinating to read, and it's why I contacted you, and you said the value of diversifying the supply chain. Well, it hit me right away, and I think everybody who's been listening to the show over the past few months and has been experiencing the same things that shop owners are experiencing. Sure. All the way down the line, this shortage of parts makes it very obvious that don't rely on just one person to get everything in the store, which is the way Schwinn used to be back in the day when everything was Schwinn approved. So in the last couple of days, Jay Townley came out with an editorial, and Rick Vosper came out with it. These are just people in the industry who are sort of riffing on what you said, saying that maybe this isn't going to be a boom. It isn't going to last that long. So let's talk about diversification. And then I want to know how it happened that we didn't see it coming and why we didn't.
Okay, sure. Let's try to look into that. So let's step back and start at the beginning, shall we? The cause, the root cause of even why this is happening. The simple reality is it's 100-year global health event resulted in hundreds of millions of people worldwide looking for any and all avenues for staying healthy and social distancing. The difference then between this and, say, the bike boom in the 70s that we had is that this time around, those consumers had two things that were not present in the 70s. They have, of course, significant, disposable income at the end of the day. And they also had a need for social distancing, neither of which were around during the last bike boom in the 70s. So you have the confluence of events here. You have, the obvious health event and the, concurrent need for social distancing. They also had money, but they had one more thing that is unique to developing societies. They had time. A lot of people working from home, they had flexibility. The bottom line is this has resulted in a boom that came out of nowhere. And it considered, the arguments, certainly that I consider, and this is something that Jay and Jay Townley and Rick Vosper might not agree to necessarily, but I think this is a very short-lived event at the end of the day. Now, it doesn't feel like it. If you own a bike shop, you don't have enough inventory on the floor, and you're getting calls every day that you're not able to handle. That gets frustrating. On to what supply chain question that you posed. Why didn't we see it coming, you asked? Well, there's really no way to plan for something that had that confluence of events that I already cited. But let's flip it around and look at it from the Asian factory standpoint. They have made a calculus that it just doesn't make sense to go buy, invest, tens of millions of euros or dollars in tooling up, buying new factories, buying new machinery for what they believe is a relatively transient growth curve. At the end of the day, the number I hear bandied about is that when this whole thing settles down in the next 16, 18, 20 months, that we'll have kept, if we kept even 10% of those new customers, fantastic. That is your new customer base. So for Asian factories, they just are deciding that they're willing to just sell out and that they're not going to tool up for this because they see it as a transitory growth phase.
Wow. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Kendall some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I am speaking with Kendall Young. He is the owner of Spin Cycle. It is a San Francisco Bay Area-based OEM brand management company. And we were talking about why the Asian factories are not going to tool up for either new factories or how about increasing capacity at old factories? I'm not hearing that. I guess one of the questions I have is now that the pandemic, and maybe it isn't under control, but in Asia, it seems to have some control over it, that the factories aren't pumping out product and getting it here, that people aren't flying product in if they need to. I know it increases the price, but it's already expensive.
So it's, I think the easiest way for your listeners to metabolize this is that the factories prior to this global health event we've been in the last 14 months or whatever, the industry was in rough stasis. And rough stasis in this case means that a PO sent by a U.S. bicycle brand to an Asian a trading company or assembly factory could typically be built in about 6 months. Basically, the short answer is that we were in rough stasis before the pandemic. So from your perspective, Diana, and I understand you're saying, well, gee, why can't they just get it here? Well, the system was balanced based on worldwide demand, the number of assembly factories, frame factories, et cetera. And now we're not in that. We're in a short period of time when we're not in that stasis. However, you know, again, back to my point, it doesn't make sense for Asian factories. Just think about it. It really doesn't make a lot of sense for them to tool up for something that they consider to be, they would rather sell out than invest in more tooling and resources is the easy way to look at it.
Clearly. Mm-hmm. All right. So you talk about, and let's circle back to the reason you wrote this editorial, and that is about diversification. And so, all right, let's look at one of the big shortages right now from our perspective, from, you know, the builder's perspective, is chains, cranks, and shifters. So these are things that are very proprietary in many cases, and you need to put an 11-speed chain with an 11-speed crank with an 11-speed set of shifters. So how do you diversify from that kind of perspective?
It's a good question. The way I describe this is think of a tent and think of the long pole in the tent. So when product managers order bars, stem posts, headset saddles, wheels, pedals, tires, chains, et cetera, et cetera, they have to order all of those parts with the long pole in the tent, meaning your drive to whichever part takes the longest to produce, let's say it's 330 days, all of your other parts deliveries need to be feathered around that one. Otherwise, what's the point of having a bunch of parts sitting around if you don't have a drivetrain, right? So, you know, languaged another way, think of baking a cake, right? It's like you need all the components in the same place at the same time to finish the cake. Yeah, the biggest bottleneck, as you rightly point out, is drivetrains. Now, when we talk about diversification, which is what I wrote about, there's some brands are elastic to that in economic terms, some are not. For instance, I can scale up. I have manufacturers that I work with that could scale up tires relatively quickly, comparatively speaking. Some extruded and molded parts, bars, stems, posts, saddles, you know, they have you know, fabric and rails, that kind of thing. You can scale those up by the tens of thousands much easier than you can drivetrain parts, obviously. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it kind of does. I guess I see drivetrains as being, you know, a chain gets spit out of a machine and just, all right, let's put another shift on. But then that's just me looking at it from we need this perspective, you know. It's like, well, make it happen.
Sure.
One of the other questions is about your crystal ball. Now, you said maybe 10 months, 20 months. You know, recently I heard 2024. What are you thinking about when the supply chain will actually catch up? And we know that they're not going to fill those warehouses the way they did in the past. That's what happened is, you know, they already had enough product and then we drained it and they were not ready to refill at that rate.
Yeah. So the numbers that I'm hearing from the brands that I call on, and again, you know, please let's recognize this is a crystal ball.
Right.
Jay Tenney will have a different view and Rick Voss, you know, so forth. It's the old, you know, there's an elephant and everybody's blindfolded and we're all hanging on one part of the elephant and the tail feels like one thing and a leg feels like another. It's right. So
it's a good analogy.
what I'm hearing is, we should be back to some sort of stasis, some sort of balance in, you know, 16 to 18 months, barring some significant new shock, you know, like a resurgence of COVID. So I think, let me put it to you this way. It's middle of April, all the product managers I work with got all their orders in. 2021 is completely sold out from a production standpoint. 2022, they're working on like Q3 of 2022. So they're working right now on essentially a year plus out. And I think we'll continue to see, you know, our delivery interruptions somewhere along the supply chain for the next year and a half. And then I think it will settle down. But let me also put this in perspective. We typically work, we're like a fashion business. We typically work a year ahead anyway. So, I guess what remains to be seen is how many people have sort of already bought the bikes they're going to buy. How many people are really, truly, and genuinely not able to buy a bike that they really want. You know, we just don't have those answers. We don't have good data around that. There's really no easy way to get it. Short, long answer is, I would say, 16 to 18 months, we really should start seeing more stasis. And let's just remember one thing. This isn't, you and I are talking here in North America. This event we're talking about is the first ever worldwide event for cycling. And it's not just cycling. I mean, go into REI, they're out of backpacks. They're out of, they're out of it. So many segments of the sporting goods supply chain are just sort of temporarily out, So I'm not the only one.
That brings me to a question that I wasn't planning to ask, but that maybe you have an answer for, and that is the opportunity that the U.S. might have in creating some bicycle groups, some bicycle parts. I mean, now we do things like headsets and hubs and, there are certain things, but that drivetrain, right now it's SRAM, Campy, or Shimano. And so Correct. Is there room for a fourth product that might come out of the U.S.?
It's a good question. I see the easy answer to this is probably not, but let me explain it by saying, it would really surprise your listeners how very intensive and expensive it is to tool up for making drivetrains for bicycles. It would seem relatively easy, but it really isn't. I've worked with what I consider secondary brand companies developing drivetrains, and it's just not that easy. And it's the deeper answer about North America, Diane, is simply, yeah, we don't have a culture for that. In Asia and Taiwan, starting, as long as I can remember, they really focused on making bicycles. And so they're literally worldwide leaders in it at this point. We just have never placed the sort of value, nor do we have a national identity around it. So the short answer here is you will see silos of high-end products. Yeah, you're right. We do machine beautiful headsets here and hubs, but they're going to be very low volume, and they probably won't do much, frankly, to ameliorate the supply issue that we already have. They're great for building a $12,000 bike, but not that good for building a $2,000 bike. Because that's my point. Yeah, I mean, I would love to say I see this as a door open. But it would only be a door open if you have the infrastructure in place for that door to open. And we really just sort of don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like we don't have this conversation like ad nauseum here at this house. But,
we've had as long as I can remember.
Well, and because my husband is an engineer and a designer, he's had these ideas. But, you get into the intricacies of an STI shifter. And the technology that comes out of these companies like Shimano and SRAM are just so far ahead. I mean, it would take years to catch up. So the last thing I'd like to ask you about is losing the potential customer who can't find what he or she wants and just says, I'm going bowling. So do you see, and you did say, I think you said maybe we could retain 10%. That actually is not a bad number.
No, that's a very good number. That's actually, you're right. That's my point. That's not a bad number. That represents a whole new generation of cyclists right there. If you just kept 10% of the growth, mind you, of the growth we're talking about here.
Right.
So, well, first of all, all kidding aside, you're not going to find the bowling ball in the sports store either. I'm not kidding when I tell you.
I picked the wrong sport, huh? Okay.
Yeah, well, I get your analogy, but I'm just saying that everything is under, supply chain pressure. I mean, car manufacturing is under supply chain pressure. Everything is. So, but back to your question, am I concerned that we would lose because of this? People throw their hands up and say, I just don't want to cycle anymore. I have no fear of that at all. several reasons. Again, having been in this 30 years, I cannot tell you how many times I thought, oh, this has got to be the beginning of the end. You know, first it was the beginning of the end when you start getting something in the mail from these national accounts, you know, that were value-based and bike shops. Oh, this is the beginning of the end. It's never been the beginning of the end. The bike industry has been around, gosh, a couple hundred years. You know, it has fascinated human consciousness for as long as anybody can remember. There's pictures of Leonardo da Vinci had sketches of bikes.
Right.
Everybody's seen the famous picture of Albert Einstein joyously riding a bike and smiling. So I don't see people giving up on cycling in any meaningful way. I just think, you know, we're not entitled to have everything we want the moment we want it. I don't think we're going to lose anybody's. If you love cycling, you still love cycling. Back to our very beginning, the analogy of the pizza, we all have a different take on it, but it's all leading towards our enjoyment of cycling. So I'm not afraid that we're going to lose anybody. I would like to see us stabilize our, you know, I'd like to see the current situation just settle down.
So the last thing, which I didn't think to ask you, but I think it's something you'll weigh in on in maybe a little bit different perspective, and that is this infrastructure chatter coming out of Washington and a new transportation secretary and a new sort of vision of what transportation looks like, and the possibility that the industry might finally latch onto that as an opportunity instead of dropping that ball in favor of competitive cycling, which they've done for decades and decades and decades.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I'm very expectant that the new administration is looking at it from how can we get as many people out of cars? How can we decentralize our major downtown areas? I think the current mood is to focus on sort of the infrastructure around our cities, which means bike lanes and encouraging, you know, safe routes to schools and this sort of thing. We've talked about it a lot, Diane, in our industry. But I think I'm very optimistic right now that there may be actually some money put behind that. You know, I one thing I will say about our country's relationship to the bicycle. It's not a straight line. It's got a lot of peaks and valleys to it. There's a couple things that I think will really help us move to the next level in our country in general. There is really, the conversation is happening about how, you know, is it possible to shut down, you know, five blocks of New York City in the center or shut down car access to San Francisco in just a five block area? And people have to walk in for safety, you know, for density reasons. I don't know if we'll get there. I do know that the e-bike has been enormously valuable to people. You actually see people in San Francisco and, you know, wearing a tie on an e-bike. And I mean a volume of them now, not just one weirdo, if you will, quote unquote, but a volume of them. It goes to the very heart of, is there a will on the part of our government to start really educating what is possible about a bicycle. And I think the e-bike is going to be a big part of that. That's an infrastructure play on of its own.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. We've been speaking with Kendall Young. He is the owner of Spin Cycle LLC out of the Bay Area in California. And the work you're doing is interesting. It's not a part of now I'm familiar with a lot of the industry, but it's not a part I know well. And I appreciate you taking time to explain it to me today.
It's been a pleasure. As I said, the guy behind the guy behind the guy.
That's you.
Your listeners wouldn't get a lot of view into that. I do have one final tip for everybody listening. So while the primary market is, of course, you know, fraught right now and a bit disrupted, the secondary market is actually vibrant. Turns out that everybody's got a bike or two or three in their garages, some of which they don't use anymore. There are, I have friends calling me saying, hey, what would you suggest I do looking for a bike? I invariably send them to the secondary market that now is very developed. It didn't used to be, but it is now. Things like the Pros Closet, Bicycle Blue Book, I tell people to go look on Craigslist. There is just a volume of bicycles out there on the secondary market. So I tend to encourage people now to go down that avenue if they're not able to find what they want in any other.
The only caveat there is if there are parts missing or parts necessary, sometimes there might be a shortage. For example, 27x1¼ tires right now.
Yeah.
Thank you so much again. I hope you have a wonderful summer. And let's hope the next time we talk, we can talk. Wow, there's stuff in the supply chain.
That'd be great. Well, listen, thanks for your time. It's lovely to speak with you.
You too. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Kendall Young is the owner of Spin Cycle LLC in the San Francisco Bay Area in California. You can find a link to his editorial, The Value of Diversifying the Supply Chain, on the Outspoken Cyclist blog at outspokencyclist.com. So my thanks to Kendall and to Randy Salem and Rich Fine from the Business Climate Leaders. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. In the meantime, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page or leave a comment on our blog at outspokencyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.